Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time around, the focus is acquisition. Our guest for the full hour is Harry Halleck, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. He's held that role since last July, but he has spent a full career in the world of Army contracting. In his current job, he's in charge of maintaining and updating the Army's acquisition regulations, overseeing more than 200 Army contracting offices around the world, and managing the way the Army handles service contracts. He's also the Army's point man for managing its acquisition workforce, and we begin our discussion there. In an interview in his office at the Pentagon, Halleck told me it's time for the workforce to shift its mindset from one that required them to deliver products as quickly as possible during wartime to one that's more focused on getting the best bang for the buck.
We've been at war for 12 years, and frankly, when you look at people discuss, hey, we want to be effective and efficient, as if they're the same thing in the same context. And frankly, they're very different. Of course, every organization, I think, would like to make sure they're doing both. But in a given situation, with DOD, for example, wartime, effectiveness takes precedence because, frankly, we were doing everything possible to provide equipment to the soldier to save lives. And when you're in that mode, you're in effectiveness mode. Do you want to be efficient? Sure you do. But effectiveness takes precedence. And so now things are kind of changing a bit, turning around. The environment's changing. The war in Iraq is over. We're winding down in Afghanistan. The environment has changed, and it's now more of an environment of, hey, guys, let's take a look at this. We need to address the efficiency issue. So in today's environment, we're concentrating more on efficiency than effectiveness. And frankly, I think we should. The concern is, when it comes to the workforce, is we have done a significant hiring effort over the last decade plus. Right. So when you look at, I think the latest figure I saw was 50.1% of our workforce has less than 10 years experience. So in my former job, before I got this job 8 months ago, this was a big concern to me. Because I think out there in Warren, Michigan, where I was a director, it was more like 60% of the workforce less than 10 years. So they grew up in an environment where effectiveness takes precedence. Get the job done. And frankly, inexperienced workforce, taking some risks, taking some shortcuts. And what's interesting is, so now we're being reviewed and audited, as we should be, in an environment of efficiency. So lots of looking back and lots of questioning, hey, was that a smart move? Frankly, two things are happening. In some cases, we're saying, hey, guess what? This was a good shortcut. We need to codify that. That's a streamlining initiative. In other cases, it's like, hey, guys, what were we thinking when we did that? We need to make sure we don't make that mistake again.
Right.
But you've got a workforce who grew up in that environment. They know no other environment. And so I've always said, hey, guys, do what you need to do to get the job done within the rules. But if you don't know the rules, you don't know the boundaries of the rules, you have more of a tendency maybe to go a little further than you should. So that was a concern. Frankly, if someone asked me, what do you lose sleep at night over? That's what I lose sleep. We raise this new workforce in an environment of effectiveness, take some risks. Not that we shouldn't be taking risks. You just need to know what the boundaries are when you're looking at taking those risks. So how do you deal with that? Hey, how do we kind of slow things down? Oh, by the way, customer expectations and, frankly, industry expectations were also increased. Hey, things were happening a little faster. So now how do you slow down that train and then deal with the customers and industry saying, wait a minute, why are things slowing down? We kind of like this faster pace. So, you know, people talk about bureaucracy and how that's a bad thing. In this case, I think what happened here, this thing called Better Buying Power 2, was the bureaucracy's answer to the issue.
Right.
And you look at Better Buying Power, and I would tell you, and some people would argue, there's not a whole lot of new there. It's not like it's some revolutionary new ideas coming out of it. It's basically OSD's answer to, hey, guys, we need to start focusing back on the basics again. Let's look at making smart decisions. Let's look at making the right decisions. Let's not just do things the way we've been doing them, because, frankly, we've got a little loose in being effective. So that's when I look at, hey, how are we going to train up this workforce to be the workforce of the next generation, make sure that they are smart business people making the right decisions, better buying power is a really good answer to that. It puts reviews in the process. It slows us down, forces us to think. And frankly, I'm fond of saying technology kind of interferes with best practices in some regards as well. I have a great saying that just because technology allows us to do it instantaneously doesn't mean we have to do it instantaneously. And so what tends to happen is people stop thinking and just doing because everyone's moving faster, faster.
Right.
Again, what the better buying power does and what we need to do as leaders in Army contracting is slow down a bit and make sure we're making the right decisions at the right times in the process.
Mm-hmm. Your point about this workforce that's grown up in the go-go-go mode is really important, I think. Every time I write a story about some new edict that's come out of the Army or OSD, frankly, I hear from your guys and they say, well, I'm not sure I signed up for this. I signed up to get stuff out the door, not to push paper around for reasons that to them just seem bureaucratic without any value added. How do you change that mindset? Do you see that?
Oh, yeah, I see. You know, it's interesting. When we first, most of my experience with hiring up to this point has been when I was out in Warren, Michigan. And we were hiring 150, 200 people a year for a good 8 years. That's bringing a lot of people into the workforce. And, of course, the concern, and this was after the decade of the 90s where we hired practically nobody. So you kind of get concerned. You hear the stories on the news about this generation of folks just sitting home on the couch playing video games, and what are we going to get into the workforce? Frankly, I'm just astounded at the caliber of people that we've been bringing into the workforce. Their intelligence, their savvy. Frankly, they seem a lot more politically savvy than I remember being when I started oh so many years ago. So from that standpoint, I wasn't worried about the workforce. But, yeah, they are a different workforce. They are IT savvy. They like doing things quickly, frankly. Let's get it done. Don't necessarily need to interact with people while they do their job. And the example I had a situation where I got involved in one of my buyers was dealing with an engineer, and they were having an email war back and forth. And at some point in the war, I got copied on an email. And the minute I saw that, I just, hey, guys, stop this immediately. I go out and I find the buyer, this young lady, maybe I'm trying to remember, maybe 5 years into her career. And I remember standing over her, and she turns around in her chair, and I said, here's what you got to do. Get up out of your seat. The engineering center was 200 yards away in another building. I said, you need to cross that field, go over, sit down with that engineer, and look him face-to-face and deal with this. And in all, I still remember her face. She turned around and looked at me and said, with this questioning look in her eyes, why? And turned and said, I've got a PC. And wow, that was a revelation to me. So yeah, they are different. It is a different environment. But it doesn't negate the need for interaction, for people to sit down in a room. Because frankly, the discussion is different when you're doing it VTC, doing it over email, than it is when you're in a room, face-to-face, watching body language, watching the eyes. And to me, that's what we've got to make sure we don't lose that as we're training people up and letting them use all this wonderful technology. But that, to me, is what gets in the way. And frankly, now I shouldn't say gets in the way. It just causes a different dynamic. And so that also leads to the premise about, and anything that slows that process down is just bureaucratic mess. There's a reason we have the processes we have. Because we do answer to the taxpayer. We do have to make smart decisions. And in the process of doing that, it takes some review and some sort of stepping back and making sure the right people who have been in this business for a while, that's the other piece of this. How do we take advantage of the expertise and the savvy and the experience of the current workforce and, frankly, getting smaller and smaller and smaller before they leave government? And one way is to make sure we have reviews where they're involved in the process so they can teach and coach the younger folks as to how to do things, why we do things the way we do.
As to your point there about the workforce getting smaller, how much smaller, why, where's that going?
Well, I when I say smaller, I'm talking about the seasoned workforce. I learned a long time ago, it's not oldsters like me. We're seasoned, we're not old. is getting smaller. Hopefully, the workforce itself, we've grown the workforce somewhere, depending on you include military or not, somewhere between 8 and 15% over the last decade. we're not quite where we thought we needed to get because, frankly, we started in a hole in 2001 after the 90s, we've learned some lessons from that. So we were trying to build from there. We were hoping to get up somewhere a little over 9,000 across the Army as far as contracting professionals. We're about somewhere between 8,400 and 8,500 now. Frankly, the environment has changed so much, the economic environment, that we know that there's downsizing coming. I'm hoping, as far as the contracting workforce goes, that we could hold our own. We need to. So that 8,500 figure, if we can stay around there, we'll be doing very good. And frankly, over the last 3 years, I believe it's been, the Army has had a hard freeze to try and start dealing with the downturn in the economy and the DoD funding. That hard freeze has resulted in a net attrition rate, just standard attrition, retirement, leaving for other reasons.
Sure.
Of 4.5%, which doesn't sound huge. But when you look at we're not replacing, so the net is 4.5%. We're estimating in 3 years we'll be right back where we were in 2001 when we started building the workforce again. So that's a huge concern. And I've discussed that concern with those above me. And the Army is aware, and we're looking at that to make sure we don't go back to doing the things we did in the 90s that got us into the mess of having a workforce that is not as large as it should be to handle the mission.
As overall budgets come down, you're obviously going to be obligating fewer dollars in the coming years. Given that, can you get by with a smaller workforce, given that you're going to be putting fewer dollars on contract?
Yeah, and yes, I would say we could. But the trick is, and frankly, we just have not been able to figure out what is, you know, the question we always get, and it's a fair question, legitimate question, which is, what is the right size of the contracting workforce? Frankly, we haven't been able to come up with a good answer. We have a lot of intuitive things that we say that we use. It's not just about the funding. It's about the number of actions. It's about the complexity of the buy. It's about whether it's a competitive buy, whether it's a sole source, what kind of expertise. There's different kinds of expertise you need on those types of situations. But we haven't nailed down. We are continuing to work on some kind of workforce model that we're comfortable indicates the right size of the workforce. But frankly, every time we think we're there, we sort of come up with reasons why, well, that didn't quite nail it. So we frankly go a little bit more into the intuitive side of this, and I would tell you we probably are going to shrink because the budgets are shrinking, but we should not shrink commensurate with either the budget cuts, or often people say, hey, the uniform side of the Army is shrinking, so you've got to shrink commensurate. And frankly, it's a different – we're the business side of this, supporting that uniform side.
Right.
And oftentimes, budget reductions result in more contracting actions because you're changing contracts, you're modifying contracts, you're reducing money, or you're doing more buys because you're spreading out the dollars. So instead of having one contract that covers a period of time, 1 to 3 years, let's say, you're doing numerous contracts because you only have money to do so much at a time. So it results in more actions rather than less. So that's what we're wrestling with in determining the right size. I think, again, my goal is to try and maintain where we're at, realizing that we're probably going to shrink a little, and we'll just need to because we got to support the rest of the Army and what their priorities are as well. But hopefully we won't shrink too much where we can't complete the mission given to us.
Harry Halleck is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. We'll pick up our conversation after a short break. This is on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is on DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. If you're just joining us, Harry Halleck is our guest for the full hour this week. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. Before the break, he told us the Army wants to do acquisition effectively and efficiently, but they're not the same thing. And it's time to rebalance the focus more toward efficiency now that the wartime environment is drawing to a close.
So that this new environment that you're in, not only is there more of a premium being placed on efficiency, but the resourcing picture is also pretty chaotic, particularly last year, I think. As you went through that with government shutdown, with furloughs, with not knowing what your budget was going to be month to month, what came out of that, do you think? Did you learn things? Did you learn to do things differently? Did you learn to plan for chaos?
Man, I love that question because we had a great example of Necessity is the motherhood of invention. So we knew early on in the fiscal year that, hey, things were going to be a bit crazy and chaotic with the budget and likelihood of furloughs as well. So how do we deal with that? So in the spring of last year, we looked at, we came up with the idea, the contracting centers out there were saying, hey, you, requirements folks, you got to help us identify what your priorities are. And it's not that they don't in the normal course of business prioritize, it's just that there wasn't always the communication of their priorities to the contracting folks who have to buy. Hey, because we need to sort of rack and stack and look at what we need to be focused on in case the things that, you know, are predicting going to happen do happen. And of course, they ultimately did. So we came up with this process called 1-to-N list. And we ask all our requirements generators, the PMs and PEOs and those folks to put together a 1-to-N list of, hey, guys, if we, what's your priorities and where would you draw a cut line? Now, of course, that's easy. I say it's easy. It's easier to do with one or two customers when you start expanding it across the Army. Where and who does the rack and stacking between the various requirements organizations? But we got through that, and frankly, even at the local level, it helped. And what that resulted in was we now had an idea of, okay, here's what we need to focus on. So when the budget did go down in the April timeframe, and we needed to meet certain statutory goals, the amount of OMA budget had to be 80% by the end of July. That didn't change when the money went down. And, oh, by the way, we didn't get the money till the April-May timeframe. How do we turn this around that quick? We had the focus items, and we knew what we were focusing on. So then when they started the furloughs and people were cut, and the furloughs took a bigger, deeper hit than I think anyone ever would have anticipated, because it wasn't just the fact that, hey, one day a week, our workforce was not showing up at work. It was the fact that in many, many, many cases, these folks already were working more than an eight-hour day, oftentimes uncompensated, because that's just the dedication of the workforce. And we were telling them, hey, guys, you can't do that either. It's an eight-hour day. Frankly, I'm concerned we broke trust with the workforce there. But they managed because of the processes we put in place. This 1-to-8 end list was just one of several that focused us on what we needed to do. When those furloughs came off, I think it was August 8th or August 6th, and we, of course, we're into the fourth quarter. We're like, guys, we got a lot more work to do before the end of the fiscal year. It was amazing, the effort. And we were frankly concerned. So we've brought the workforce off a period of, hey, only put in your 32 hours a week to, okay, it's over now, turn on the engines again. And we weren't sure they were going to they came through amazingly well. Not only did the workforce go right back to, hey, what do we need to do to get the job done, but we now had a list that focused us on, these are the things we need to get done. And as a result, we pretty much managed to do everything we needed to do, not everything we wanted to do, but everything we needed to do by the end of the fiscal year.
Those coping mechanisms like the 1-to-N lists, the things that you put in place in 13, do you see those as emergency measures to deal with extraordinary times last year? Are those enduring things that you're going to repeat going forward?
Actually, what's happened now is that was so successful. And when we started talking about, here's what we did, here's the process, it went all the way up to the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, who heard about this process and said, we need to codify this. So that is now an enduring process, which is just fantastic. The interesting part of it is, so it was basically a pretty simple measure of, folks, how do we get from here to there? And between the contracting folks and the requirements generators, the PMs, the PEOs, and others. Now that we've seen the success of it, we're looking at, okay, can that help in, hey, maybe the budgeting process, maybe the funding process, what do we fund first? So now you've got other pieces of the Army organization involved in this process, and a concern is that you lose the original reason for doing the effort. But frankly, it so far that hasn't happened, and now it's become, not only did we codify this relationship between the requirements generators and the contractors, but now we have the funding folks, the resource management folks looking at this and using it to help us determine what do we need to do and when. So it's been a great success story.
Harry Halleck is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. He's our guest for the full hour this week. When we come back, we'll talk more about some of the organizational changes the Army's made to its contracting commands, the Army's small business goals, and service contracting, something Halleck predicts the Army will make a lot of progress on in the coming year. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian.
Management Friday on Federal News Radio. Friday mornings at 10, listen for the American Federation of Government Employee Workforce Perspective on Inside Government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to learn the best career path for you. Management Friday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. If you're just joining us, Harry Halleck is our guest this week for the full hour. He's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. We've spent most of our discussion this hour on how the Army's adapting from a wartime environment when money flowed freely to a more resource-constrained one. Halleck says it's time for the Army to rebalance from a wartime focus on effectiveness, getting products and services on contract as quickly as possible, to one of efficiency.
Another piece of the efficiency environment is, I know one of the things that you're working on is trying to make the overall procurement enterprise Army-wide a little bit better optimized, I think is the word you use. Tell me about some of the things that are going on there, some of the changes that you've made organizationally.
Well, we're looking at, again, how can we be more efficient as well as effective. One of the initiatives we had, we have going, and it's ongoing now, is what we call single HCA. The HCA is the head of the contracting activity, and the contracting folks report to that individual for contracting authority in any given command. In Army Materiel Command, which is our biggest buying command, there were 9 heads of contracting activity across the command. When we look at that, we several years ago, back in 2008, as a matter of fact, we created this thing called Army Contracting Command, which sits inside Army Materiel Command, brought all the contracting organizations within AMC together under one umbrella. So then when you looked at the efficiencies of doing something like that, and frankly, effectiveness as well, because now there's a synergy created where this is a big organization with desperate locations that are now working together. When you put that in place, then you question, but then we have all these different higher authority levels that are still in place. So it was basically the next step. I don't think we realized it when we put together Army Contracting Command that would be the next step, but it was. So created the single HCA. So now that 4-star commander at AMC is the single head of contracting activity inside of AMC. The idea is more consistency across the center. Now the guidance that comes down is consistent guidance. Folks can work together to look at how the different ways we are doing things. Now that we've got a single HCA, how can we combine those to look at, hey, what's the best? What are the lessons learned? And what can we do to learn from each other? And then commensurate with that, one of the concerns was, frankly, a very legitimate concern, are we going to bottleneck decision authority at that level? I mean, that 4-star is a busy guy, and contract is one of a lot of other missions he needs to worry about. So we looked at the AFARS, is the Army Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement that we use. We looked at that and noticed that there are authorities that were delegable down by statute or regulation from the HCA down to what we call the Principal Assistants Responsible for Contracting, our PARCs, and they're the lead contracting person in any given organization, that hadn't been delegated. So when we looked at that, we ran through them all. There were actually 7 of those that we said there's no reason not to delegate them down to that PARC level, because frankly that's where the expertise is in contracting in the Army at that PARC level. So we delegated that down, which was a significant, it's powering down, it was a significant improvement in the process in doing so. And we don't think we're taking any risk or losing any authority or review authority by virtue of doing that. So those are 2 big initiatives that we've taken in the Army. And now we're looking, and it's making a lot of folks nervous, frankly. At some point, we're going to step back and take a look, okay, was this successful? And if it was, should we look at other aspects of the Army contracting enterprise to see if in some form or fashion they would fit into a model like this? Don't have any answers on that yet, and frankly, we shouldn't have any answers yet because we still are. We haven't even. This happened in February where we created the single HCA. We want to go through at least 1 fiscal year cycle, and frankly, fourth quarter, which is always kind of our crazy time of year, to see what the impacts are before sort of taking a step back and looking at it and saying, okay, what do we need to do to go further, or do we need to go further?
As far as developing that consistency, is part of the reason behind that, or one of the benefits anyway, that from an industry perspective, Army contracting activities kind of look the same throughout and operate the same?
Excellent point. Yes. Yes. I mean, one of the biggest complaints I get when I do my reach out efforts with industry is the inconsistency when they deal with different centers, different commands, different organizations. And that is a concern of ours. And we are trying to get better. Frankly, several things are helping that. Automation and the technology issues where we're all using similar technology is helping. That sort of forces a little more discipline as far as consistency goes. But also the fact that we're now talking with each other, comparing notes, working under one contracting authority, definitely one of the goals is when you have either a customer or industry come in to deal with a contracting organization, that there is more consistency so they don't have to do different things depending on what organization they're dealing with. We've got a ways to go with that, but that's a goal.
And then under that, just sort of rules and procedures about who's allowed to talk to each other, when and at what points in the process. Is that kind of gelling into one culture?
Frankly, I probably not. I am trying to do my best, and this is another a point I try to make anywhere I go. I am, frankly, after being in this business for 34-plus years, most of it out in an execution command, doing the day-to-day job when I was a buyer or contracting officer, the issue of who you can talk to and when, I'm fascinated. Even the big guys that deal with DOD day in and day out, the feedback I get is that they are very leery of talking with the government if it's something that's a bit controversial or they have an issue with what we're doing. And that just amazes me because, frankly, you should always be able to talk to someone in the government at any time in the process. Now, there are some rules that, hey, once we release a solicitation, put something on the street, you should be communicating with that contract specialist or the contracting officer. But other than those times, I mean, we need input from industry to do the job we do. And the issue with us is making sure that we're doing that fairly, that when we ask for input, we're asking for input from all, not just some, and that when we answer questions and respond to issues, that we make sure that we proliferate that information to anyone who might be interested in a given buy. That's why I think what tends to happen is, let's say during the course of a solicitation on the street, someone calls and asks a question of the buyer. The buyer then has to research that question to see what the proper answer is. And then the decision is, okay, is this something that will affect the solicitation? If it does, we need to get that information out to everyone. That sometimes takes time. So people think they're not getting an answer. We're not doing anything about it. And in actuality, what's happening is, hey, most of the time in this business, especially on the weapon system side, but I tell you across the board, there isn't always easy answers. So it takes time to get the answer. And then also deciding how we're going to proliferate that. Oftentimes it results in an amendment to the solicitation or a notice to offers about a given situation. And what I tell folks out there when I'm out talking to them is, hey, we want those questions. We want your input. We want to know if we're doing something wrong. It's a lot easier to address and fix early in the process before we award a contract than dealing with it in a claim situation or litigation after contract award. So don't be afraid to contact us. And I'm not naive enough to know that the concern that I hear voiced to me often is we're afraid that if we complain about something, we'll be put on some blacklist or something like that. And frankly, I poo-poo it. Now, I'm not naive. There's probably some bad things that go on. There's some bad habits that we need to get after and look at. But in general terms, we're so rule-bound, so process-oriented, we haven't got time to put together any kind of blacklist. And I would tell you, the good contracting folks that work out there, and I think that's the vast, vast majority, know that we want input, good or bad, because we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing, because it just benefits all.
And then in the pre-solicitation phase, I know one of the things you guys have been doing for probably a couple years now is trying to do more RFIs, more draft RFPs. What's the response from industry been like that? Are you satisfied with what you're getting? Is that attitude working?
I would tell you it's mixed. We are getting more input and feedback, but frankly, we're not getting as much as we thought we were going to get. And we have to look. One good example is now we oftentimes do industry days after we've released a solicitation to bring industry and those who are interested in the solicitation to try and get feedback, okay? Explain what we're doing, why we're doing it, and then get feedback on, okay, does that translate in the document we put out there on the street? Oftentimes, in those settings where we bring everyone together in a big room and have that discussion, the discussion doesn't take place because, frankly, folks don't want to say a lot in front of their competitors. So, and we understand that now. I think it took us a while to figure out why are these things not working so well. So the issue is how do we want that feedback. One of the mechanisms we've tried was, okay, maybe if we did it individually. The issue and the concern we have if you do it individually is that we say something or, unwittingly give information to one offer that we haven't given to the rest. And we are very fearful of that, frankly, because we want to maintain that level playing field. So we actually tried an experiment where we did the one-on-ones, but the government wasn't allowed to say anything. We were only in receive mode. That way we reduced the risk of saying something that we don't tell all. And I would tell you that was a pretty stilted kind of. We got information out of it, but I don't know if that's ultimately the answer. So we're still playing with that to look at, hey, what is the best way to get input? The draft RFPs we send out, and like you said, the requests for information, we're getting feedback from those. I'm concerned, small business is a big part of what we're trying to engage small business and get as many of those involved in the process as possible. They tend not to provide feedback, is my experience. So we're trying to get at why aren't you providing that feedback? Oftentimes, they either provide it to a prime they're dealing with, and it doesn't necessarily get up to the government, or they're lost in the fodder. So we also got to figure out how we expand the ability to get information from all players in the process. It's a work in progress. I think we're heading in the right direction. I think we still got to do some things to figure out how to encourage more engagement.
That's Harry Howlick, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. We'll wrap up our conversation with an update on the Army's move to shore up its processes around service contracting and its small business goals after one more break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
We're back on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment with Harry Howlick, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. He's been telling us about the shift he thinks the Army contracting workforce needs to make from one that's focused on efficiency after it spent the last decade or more with a focus on getting equipment out the door as quickly as possible with cost as a second priority. He thinks it's time to slow down and focus more on efficiency, which is probably going to mean the newest members of the workforce, who've spent their entire careers up until now in a get-it-now mindset, are going to have to shift their focus to a get-it-smartly mindset. Workforce issues are only one part of Halleck's job, though. We'll spend our last segment on a couple of others.
In our last few minutes, I think one of the things that's in your wheelhouse is acquisition of services. And this is not only an Army problem. I think every service would freely admit that we don't do this as well as we do products, or we don't have the processes in place to do it as much as we do products. What's going on in that area? What are you doing to improve?
Well, I'll start with saying that, I freely admit we're not where we need to be with the purchase of services. And frankly, a part of the issue I look at when you get something new, and services just sort of grew exponentially right beneath our eyes, and we weren't seeing it and seeing the differences. We're good, I believe, we're very good at buying hardware, and we were treating services like hardware. One of the reasons I think we've been so slow to change is, frankly, the contracting folks are usually the first ones to see something new coming down the pike, because we have to implement the regulation or the statute or whatever. And in this case, we didn't get our arms around it. So we usually then proliferate the knowledge to our customers. So that wasn't happening. So now we've got all that. We understand, hey, folks, I think the last figure I saw is 64.9% of Army spend last year was on services. Whoa, that is a significant portion. So we've created in the Army now, I really think this is going to be a good year for services. I have a senior services manager that works directly for me. He's got a team of folks that are not only looking at, hey, how do we do services better, and we've put things in place. For example, we have portfolio managers now that look at a specific type of service across the Army, not just within their command, and pulling together ideas and requirements from all the various commands across the Army to look at purchasing services in a particular way for a particular type of service. This sort of folds right into strategic sourcing. I think the way to get at services better is also look at it from a strategic sourcing point of view. Hey, frankly, we all buy certain types of services, and we buy them differently. Why are we doing that? And I would tell you, and so we're making progress there. I mean, my Tommy Marks, who works for me as a senior services manager, is on the road going around teaching not just requirements generators, but leadership of the Army who think, well, that's an acquisition problem, not my problem. And to teach them, yes, it is. It's sort of commander's business. It's leader's business because it starts with your organization. You may not think you're involved in the acquisition process, but if you have pens, paper, Blackberries, whatever, you are involved in the process because that process provides those products to you. So by educating them and looking at, hey, this whole services thing starts with what services do we need? And I really think that's where we're going to save the bucks, because when you start looking at it and consolidating, you're going to see that we do a lot of duplication here unwittingly, but we do. So that's our goal this year, is to get after that. And I think you're going to see some significant progress this year and next year. And frankly, the funding cuts are forcing that as a forcing function for us as well, because we're looking at it as we've got to save money. This is a place that's ripe for savings.
A point that the OSD folks have made fairly often is that the people who are generally buying services are out there in the field. They're purchasing them in order to meet their individual missions. They're not part of the acquisition community writ large most of the time. Is that kind of what these portfolio managers are supposed to do, to kind of provide that technical expertise and advice to people who are not used to doing a lot of acquisition?
Exactly. And in addition to the portfolio managers, we have what we call command service executives, which are the next level up, that are looking across their commands at, okay, what are those requirements? And exactly what you said, the folks that are usually out there generating those requirements are not familiar with the process. They just know they have a need, or they think they have a need. You know, part of the issue is to look at, is there really a need, and exactly how do we fill that need? So with services, you want to look at, I mean, it's dicier than hardware. Yeah, what do I need? I need a product and I need this many. With services, there's a lot of overlapping just by nature of the types of services we buy. You know, supporting a post camper station, our base operations, a lot of different functions and a lot of different commands on a given installation. And unwittingly buying the same service to do the same things in regard to facilities on the command. That's where I think we can get some significant savings.
And it seems to me that not only is there probably duplication and inefficiency out there, there's probably a lot of services that have sort of accumulated over the past dozen years because they're nice to have, not because they are necessary. So are you trying to weed some of that out?
Here's an example I use is you look at Blackberries. They have proliferated across the government, and they're a useful product. We need them. The service that goes along with that product, that BlackBerry instrument, is the service provider. And frankly, the government, and again, to be competitive, and we use all different service providers in any given scenario. So one of the things you can look at is, okay, in buying that piece of that BlackBerry product or that service provider, we could consolidate that and save lots of money. But I will tell you, and that's a good thing, and we're looking at that, but we're not going to save near as much as if we step back and those folks out there that don't think they're a part of the acquisition process, that are saying, hey, I need this. I have 20 folks in my organization, and I need 15 BlackBerries for those 20 folks, to stop and look at, okay, why is there a need? What is the requirement? What do those folks do that require them to be tethered to the office 24/7? And when you start asking that question, you start getting answers of, well, maybe I don't need as many as I thought. And that's where I think really we're going to get bang for the buck.
Last thing before we run out of time, small business. I know you met your goals last year, which was maybe a little bit of a surprise given the budget environment. I don't know. How does that look going forward? Did you figure out how to do that in a repeatable way that you think you're going to be able to pull off in 14, 15, and beyond?
Frankly, 13 was a surprise. It wasn't only a surprise for us, but we meet monthly with OSD and our service counterparts and the other defense agencies to discuss small business. It's actually very important to us. Everyone was surprised, but by virtue of the Army sort of carries the DOD when it comes to small business. Just by the nature of the types of buys we have, they're more conducive. So the Air Force, Navy, Army, we all try very, very hard, and we have missed our goal the last couple of years, and then last year we did make it. Whether we crack the code or not, I would tell you it's always an ongoing initiative. So far this year, we've got first quarter stats, actually second quarter, And we're meeting the goals that to be where we need to be at the point that point in the year, which that is a little bit of a surprise too, because 13 was such an anomaly. We think the reason we met that goal was some of the buying was moved up earlier in the fiscal year in an effort to address the funding issues later in the year. And this year that didn't happen. And frankly, fourth quarter is where a lot of the buys that we do are more competitive. They're smaller because they take more time to plan. Happen in the fourth quarter. So that's where we sort of make up ground. And we're very comfortable now that we have, we're meeting our goals up to this point in the fiscal year that we're going to meet it next year. I don't know that there is any crack in the code other than keeping it on the front burner, making sure when we make decisions that we're looking at the small business aspect of it. And it's just kind of the day-to-day grunt work of, don't forget, we got to, you know, do everything we can to support them. And that's happening. And so I'm comfortable that we'll continue. We certainly will continue to have that right in the middle of our radar screen and continue to try and make the goal.
Fingers crossed. And with that, we're going to have to leave it there. Mr. Halleck, thanks for doing this. It's been a really interesting hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Harry Halleck is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement. We spoke in his office at the Pentagon. That's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening to On DoD this week. Please join us again next week. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.